Welcome to the Thinking Fellows podcast. My name is Caleb, and once again, I am joined by Dr. Scott Keith, Rod Rosenblatt, and our friend Aaron Peterson. Hey, Aaron, you gonna
Peterson?
How's it going?
Trying to hype you up, trying to get you.
You don't need excited. More than that.
We ran out of bourbon. No, just kidding.
More whiskey.
We have a lot of here. We just came back from lunch. We did. This is a long recording session day for us because, you know what? It's going to be the holiday season. You know, it's going to be Christmas.
There
we go. Not to be confused, the holiday season, I include Thanksgiving in there. Mm-hmm. So it's not like I'm being PC.
We do live in Irvine.
So, I'm not being PC. I'm just like, you know, there's a lot going on right now.
In Big Bear, we celebrate Christmas.
That's right.
Just when crazy. I was in Santa Barbara, it was the winter solstice.
Oh, Lord have mercy.
Okay. So, and people's schedules get really tight, so we try to get some blocks of episodes out of the way. And today, on this episode, we're going to talk about vocation. Now, we've done vocation in the past. We've done it in a couple different ways. We've done specific vocations, like father or preacher. We did a general Lochi episode on vocation, and just 3 weeks ago, I did an episode on the liberal arts and classical education and kind of how that informed your vocation and neighbor in your life with Dr. Francisco and Dr. Armstrong just a couple weeks ago. And so we thought after doing two episodes on repentance and errors and the proper way of understanding justification that, of course, the now what question is going to come back up again, right? And so this is kind of why we always find ourselves in a pattern here of doing these episodes that surround justification, and then when people start asking the "well, now what?" question, we end up getting back to vocation. So it may seem like we're repeating ourselves a little bit here, but I think every time we come back to this, we can bring in new discussions that we've been having off the air, amongst each other, or at events that we're having. We can take into account questions that we've gotten from listeners that maybe spark the need to do a topic like this, several times. As Dr. Rosenblatt said, you know, the worries that people have regarding salvation, regarding works and things like that, they never go away. Mm-hmm. And so we really can't talk about this kind of stuff too much.
No, I don't think so. And I think the funny thing is that we ended the last podcast, which was supposed to be on synergism, basically talking about good works what does it mean and how are they measured and that type of thing. And I think that, first of all, one of the reasons we asked Aaron to come today is because Aaron and I have this conversation all the time. I mean, Aaron's a classically trained theologian who is now a fine woodworker. And so conversations about, you know, what is my vocation? What does it mean to be a woodworker? What does it mean? It would even tie into what you did with Dr. Armstrong, you know, how does your liberal arts education inform what you do as a woodworker?
And that type of thing. We did that. Like what value does, you know, a lot of what we pursue offer?
Yeah.
If it doesn't offer anything to our salvation or our status before God.
Yeah. And I encountered this question when I was full time at the university. One of the aspects of my job was to help with the freshman seminar class, which they call it something different, like vocation and something or another.
Yeah, I actually think they took the curriculum you helped build and kind of named it after that.
They did, and they used a book that I worked on with Dr. Ashman on the vocation of student for that class now, too. But, I mean, long story short, the question was, how do you teach an incoming student what the vocation of student is, mm-hmm. especially in this day and age when...
Good question.
It's not very intuitive from their previous education
right.
what it actually means. You know, it means doing what you're told and showing up and taking the test when you're supposed to take the test and giving the answers you're supposed to give. And is that what it means at the university level? And so we were really wrestling with that. And even now, even though I'm not there full time, they still have me come back in and I do the massive set of lectures to all the freshmen on the vocation of student. Because I think it's, you know, if we don't understand this correctly as Christians, it's very easy for us to fall back into believing that we have to, I guess, in our sanctification, serve God in some special way.
Yep.
And that, as much as we would like to believe, and even as much as other traditions would like to believe that that's never going to affect your soteriology. Inevitably, it does. I mean, inevitably, you're not just doing these quote-unquote special things for God because he likes you more if you do. Inevitably, you're doing these special things for God because your salvation is in some way linked to it and or dependent on it.
Yep.
So it's very, I think it's very important to get this right. And as somebody who's a student of the Reformation, I also think, and Dr. Rosenblatt has said this many times on this show, that you know, as much as we would all like to believe that the doctrine of the Reformation that changed the world was the doctrine of justification, if we sort of set our minds to it, we'd probably discover that it was the doctrine of vocation that changed, you know, everything very dramatically.
And in our circles, the one who's done the clearest, simplest work on it is Dr. Veith.
Absolutely.
Jean Edward Veith. I think one of them is called God at Work. Mm-hmm. And in it, he credits and says he stole it all from Gustav Wingren.
Luther on vocation.
Luther on vocation. But that's just humble of Dr. Veith. He didn't steal it all.
Having read both of them, I think that that's probably not an accurate representation of God at work. Dr. Veith has done another book in the meantime on vocation. It's a more academic work. I'm struggling to remember the title of it. But anyway, the one in our circles that really has done the work on it is Gene Veith. The book is God at Work. It's what we ended up assigning at the university for the students to read in this freshman seminar class.
Mm-hmm.
For that very reason. It's
good
it's
choice.
Absolutely. It's called, the other title he's done is called Working for Our Neighbor, a Lutheran Primer on Vocation, Economics, and Ordinary Life. So it's very good as well.
The wonderful thing about Dr. Veith is not only is he so theologically educated, he can write clear English sentences.
But to the lay level.
Yeah. His background is in English.
Yeah.
And sort of like Lewis, he'd never claim that, but he can write a clear English sentence. And if you ask most people, they'd say, well, theologians certainly can't.
Right. They're correct. I agree with that statement. Mm-hmm. So why is this so important? So let's set the stage here. I'm going to make Aaron contribute a little bit more on this, some of the work that he's done, that I know he's done and we've talked about. But why is this so important? I mean, the reality is that here at 1517, we say all the time that our primary focus is sharing the gospel of Christ Jesus with as many people as possible in as many ways as possible. You know, and to that end, we support several different projects that are aimed at that same goal. But the funny thing is, we often get the now what questions too, right? Mm-hmm. So we pound home the gospel of Christ Jesus 200 proof, and people will literally say, I came to believe. Mm-hmm. Right? And the question that comes after that is, now what? And it's either now what, how, what, you know, God's done, I now realize that God's done this for me in Christ Jesus, now what can I do for God? Or I realize that this is a free gift given to me on account of Christ Jesus. Now what can I do, period? And sometimes the what can I do answer, when you give it clearly, especially if that question is phrased, now what can I do for God, is sort of devastating to them. Because to be honest, you know, the theologian has to say, the theologian of the cross at least has to say, nothing. Mm-hmm. You can do nothing. That can be somewhat devastating initially if they're just left hanging there. But there's good news, and this is not a new question. This happened to Luther. But the good news is there is plenty for us to do as Christians. The difference is that what we do is aimed at our neighbor, mm-hmm. and not at God, right? In sort of in a maybe a surreptitious way, what we don't always get is that by doing these things for neighbor, we're doing them for God, right?
Yep.
So this past Sunday, we referenced it in the other two shows. We had the parable of the sheep and the goats, that was the pericope for the week, and it's at the end of that parable where Christ literally says, you know, whatever you've done for two or three of the least of these my brethren, you've done for me, right? And that's essentially the doctrine of vocation. I mean, the reality is like this. The almighty creator of heaven and earth didn't need your help to speak into existence the universe,
yep.
right? That same God didn't need your help to speak into existence your salvation on account of Christ. He doesn't need your help. He is, that's why we give him all the omni attributes, right? He's all powerful. He's all knowing. He's all present. He doesn't need you, but he has placed people into your life that do need you. He has called you to serve them freely, and we call those people neighbors. And the question that often comes up after that is, so how do I know who's my neighbor? You know, that one's actually pretty simple, too. They're the people that when you wake up in the morning and you open your eyes and you look around, that they're closest to you. And we kind of, when I think about this, and we've talked about this on the show, I sort of look at this like concentric circles working outward, right? So I know who my neighbors are because I have another name for them that's called family, right? I know who my neighbors are because I have another name for them that's called friends, right? I actually have literal physical neighbors that are my neighbors. People live close to me. They're my neighbors. I have people that I work with. They're my neighbors. I have people that live in the same town as I do. They're my neighbors. Same state, same country. But the ones I'm called most directly to are the ones that I see every single day. My wife, you know, on those good weeks when I see my children and my grandchildren very often, my coworkers, that type of thing. They're my neighbors. And anytime I do anything, even when I don't know I'm doing it, and maybe I'd say even especially when I don't know I'm doing it, that I do it for something for them, I'm in turn serving God. This came out early with Luther, very early. I mean, I think this is early 1520s. He's walking around, and the gospel that he's, you know, rediscovering in the moment is getting around just Wittenberg. And the man comes running up to him and says, Dr. Luther, Dr. Luther, I've heard and I believe Christ Jesus has saved me. Now what can I do? And Luther, knowing that this man was working on the sort of medieval version of the system where the answer would be sell everything you have, go join a monastery and become a monk, sees this in the man and says, what is it that you currently do? The man, of course, says, I make shoes. That's where you get the famous line where Luther says, well, then, go back to your shop, make your shoes, make them quality, sell them at a fair price, and know that in doing so, you're doing so to the glory of God. I mean, that's life-changing. Mm-hmm. And if we see things that way, it actually is not only gives purpose in our daily life, both in the left-hand and in the right-hand kingdom, but it actually can protect us against believing that there is in fact something that we can do here that will some way add to our salvation.
Yeah. And usually spiritual quote.
Yeah. Quote. Yeah. And Luther has many, many lines like this.
So. He one time said that a mother changing the baby's diapers is doing more than any monk or nun ever did.
Yeah.
Down at the most prosaic level.
Right. Yeah. He gets pretty colorful about some of those descriptions when he does that too, you know, and some of those lines when he talks about the work of the mother, he'll say that the mother nursing a child is doing more good works than 1,000 monks combined have ever done.
Yep.
And we have to ask, well, why is that? I mean, why is it so important? Well, because that mother is actually serving the person freely that she's called to serve directly.
Yep.
You know, and I worry about that sometimes in our day and age with students and sort of this, what do they call it, missionary tourism and everything, where
yeah.
they go off for a 14-day or even a semester-long endeavor somewhere else. It's, quote-unquote, for God and a missionary exercise.
Yeah, that can be worrisome for the deep level that it's teaching, what it's teaching.
Yeah.
It isn't exactly vocation.
Yeah, not because those thing like, you know, building houses in Mexico or something like that is bad, but because you might, you know, implant the idea that that's the only way that you can, you know, serve your neighbor type things. These extremes that you gotta go find that far off neighbor, that it's not really doing good works or serving your neighbor if it's people you like serving or like being around.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's too obvious.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So then you can even get deep and you can, I mean, obviously Luther thought that that somebody who made shoes was doing so to the glory of God, as somebody who makes cabinets or tables doing so to the glory of God. Are you serving, or is it to the glory of God when you make a table? Mm-hmm. When my son makes a knife, you know, is that in some way service to neighbor? I mean, and One of the times when I taught this, I was actually out doing Being Dad, and I did this as one of the sections. And somebody said, are there any vocations that we could think of that don't serve God? And I said, well, you'd probably have to extend, you'd probably have to get into hyperbole and extend into things that probably aren't legitimate vocations, right? Or that...
Well, maybe raising poppies in Afghanistan.
Yeah.
That find their way here in heroin.
Yeah. Prostitution. Mm-hmm. You know, you have... The thing is, though, you have to go pretty deep, right? You have to go pretty sideways with some of that to get into that.
Yeah. I think one of the other questions that that people have is, you know, how is my vocation, these normal things, any different, better... than a non-Christian who does the same thing. So like the example of, the mother, there's plenty of non-Christian mothers that take care of their children just as well, if not better than some believers.
I know what Luther would answer to that. He would say, it is entirely praiseworthy at the civic level. Not justifying, but entirely praiseworthy. Calvin had to deal with that, too. What about the noble works of pagans? He said their gifts from heaven never acknowledged.
Yeah. I sometimes go... So if you think... If the listeners, if they listened... I don't know. I think it was 2 episodes ago. We talked... the episode on synergism, right? Where we talked about the fact that most people, even most Christians, believe... Well, most... A lot of people who identify themselves as Christians believe... That how one gets to heaven is by sort of doing their best, right?
Mm-hmm.
So let's take Christians out of the picture for a second. If most people who are not specifically Christian and they believe in some amorphous God out there, right, and they think that there is a better life after death and that how one gets there is by just doing their best, if that's what they think, and they in turn then act as a good mother, that's not only civil, that's in some way them trying to participate in the doing the best they can to get the reward,
mm-hmm.
which is, that's the category of trying to fulfill the law in order to be saved.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so for me, the distinction is that the Christian, the person who relies on Christ alone and yet still does these things, right, still, because if dealing with my children day in and day out, which can be a royal pain in the rear,
mm-hmm.
isn't going to get me any eternal reward, why do it, right? Mm-hmm. So the pagan who thinks, well, if I just try to be good enough, then I know I'll get a reward, well, you can almost say, well, I know why you're doing it. And to some degree, you think that you think you have to be nice to me. You think that you have to be the best you can be. That's the only way to get your reward. But if I am a Christian and I know that the best I can be will never be good enough, and it's only on account of Christ alone that I get my eternal reward, why would I put up with my children day in and day out?
Good question.
Yeah, it's a freedom thing. And this is where Luther and the freedom of the Christian says, you know, the Christian is free servant to none, free lord of all, and free servant of all. You know, you have this distinction that you serve now, but you serve freely. This is not a servitude that comes out of slavery or bondage to sin, death, and the law, but it's a service that comes knowing that you're not going to get anything back out of it necessarily, or you're at least not going to get the ultimate thing, because the ultimate thing has already been won.
That's right, because it's already been finished. So to think in terms of wages, pleasing, impressing, earning, all that's gone.
Yeah.
Because Christ did all of the earning for us and freely gives us the benefits.
Yeah, amazing.
So whatever the answer is, it ain't that one.
Nope. Yeah.
All right. We're going to take a quick break and then we'll be back. Hey, welcome to our break. Today we're going to talk about a book that we've talked about
once or twice.
You know, like 25 times of the break. But it's a new edition. We have the second edition of Dr. Keith's Being Dad is out now. The second edition isn't honestly that different from the first edition. But if you didn't get the first edition. This is a is really great to have. It has been the cover has been redesigned, and it's absolutely beautiful. Peter Voth, who has designed the Thinking Fellows logo and many other things for 1517, redid the cover of your book, and it looks fantastic. You have some revisions in there, a new opening section.
Yeah, new opening section. I mean, essentially what happened is, one, we sold enough of them, and I went and spoke enough on Being Dad to realize where some of the minor holes were, if that makes any sense. And they were minor. And so the changes, if you've read the first edition, you read the second edition, beyond the new preface, you probably wouldn't notice a big change. But I made some tweaks in there. And basically what happened is, when I was out teaching Being Dad, so for me this was a complete grace category, because I had never heard anything as freeing as this. But my perspective was one who, not having had a father, I really only wanted this thing in my life of being a dad. And so when I heard Dr. Rosenblatt's explanation of it at Concordia, there's not one part of it that sounded like law to me, right? But when I went out and taught this, I was originally very surprised at how many times the people in the audience received this as law, received what I felt as my encouragement and sort of recognition of the importance of their role of as father, received it as law. In other words, I was one more person telling them the thing that they had to do.
Well, you received it as a very early father too, right? You hadn't had a lot of time to, quote unquote,
mess
things up.
Yeah, you were, months old at the time.
Yeah.
So that was interesting to me. So in the new preface, I try to speak to that a little bit, and it's basically, if I were to sum it up, the new preface is me sort of begging the reader to sort of give me the benefit of the doubt as they go through this, that the gospel and forgiveness is coming around in this thing. And I think even in the preface, I do a little absolution just to say,
good.
Listen, I get that some of you are going to hear this as law. That's, I don't think, what the inherent message is, and that's certainly not the intent. The intent is recognition of the importance of your role as father. And what kind of magic and really what an apologetic endeavor it is for your children. And so those are some changes, some other sort of tweaks along the way aimed at that same end. And then just, some catches that we had, maybe a couple grammatical catches and that type of thing.
So basically a cleaned up and honed in, kind of version. So you can go ahead and look at that at shop.1517legacy.com or on Amazon. So, and that new edition right now is available only as a hardcover, but it's a cheap hardcover. The way we were able to print this thing in a big run, because we had sold so many before, we were able to get the cost of the hardcover second edition to only like $2 more than the old softcover. So that's really cool too. So you get a really high quality book for your $16.
Makes a great gift.
That's right, with the Christmas coming around.
Buy multiple.
Yeah. Well, I used to be very, and I don't want to sound arrogant, but I used to have a hard time saying that to people. Even when I went out to go first start speaking on it, I have a hard time saying, hey, you should buy a couple of these. But I've received enough emails now from people saying that I bought it, I read it, found myself having to buy two more to give away, that I think that I could sort of deflect that this isn't just coming from me, that this is coming from people like you, Aaron, and others who say, listen, you need to give this away.
Absolutely.
So, okay.
Perfect.
All right. I was going to say, one of the things we were talking about at the break was pretty fun. It had to do with the fact that when I was sort of describing the conversion process, right, or the conversion, and people come and then they say, hey, what can I do now? And Aaron reminded me that what they're really representing is that the gospel, the realization of the gospel, and when one sort of comes to this free salvation understanding, brings with it some passion, right? And there's some excitement. There's a movement there that happens. A person's going from utter despair to joy and belief and gratitude and all of this, and there's some passion. Okay, so that passion that comes in through the realization of the gospel of Christ for you, it can often lead to people thinking that they need to sort of be professionals at this, you know, pastors, DCEs, and we've spoken to it a bit, but is that the necessary response?
Well, I think yes and no. To be a professional means that you get paid for it, and so in that respect, no. But to be proficient at it, yes. You know, the passion that we experience, that you and I experience in college under Rod, and that those Dudamos events, those dynamite events of the Reformation and of justification, that freedom that comes through Christ and Christ alone, those should be nurtured, you know, day after day. Your kids are going to need it. Your wife is going to need it. Your husband, your friends. But do you need to be paid for it? No, not at all. It's the passion, though, it needs to be taken wherever you go. So my kids like to eat. They like to have clothes. They need orthodontics, you know, all the basic necessities of life. And for that, you need to be paid for what you do. So whether it's a pastor or a professor or a woodworker or an electrician, you know, you need to offer a service that people are willing to pay for, to buy, and offer it at a fair price, and be able to support your friends and family, and the passions should come along with it.
Yeah, there's one of my favorite authors over the last several years has been, his name is Matthew B. Crawford. He wrote a book called Shop Class, like, you know, you're taking wood shop in high school, Shop Class as Soul Craft. Mm-hmm. And in that, he's basically, I mean, he makes several arguments in there, but primarily what he's arguing for is that the life of the mind is in many ways best engaged through the work of the hands, right? Mm-hmm. That we are so focused in our society these days on everybody being a quote-unquote knowledge worker, mm-hmm. that we've lost the reality that we want these people to have knowledge, right? We want them to have the benefit of education, but that knowledge and that education is sometimes best expressed when somebody's doing something with their hands and engage in that way. And I think there's a parallel here.
It's the first time I've ever heard that thesis, too.
Oh, really? Did you read have you read the book?
No.
Oh, it's really good. It's was a New York Times bestseller for
I can't even think of a parallel.
Yeah.
Crawford, a PhD from Chicago.
Yeah, University of Chicago. Political philosophy PhD.
Yeah, spends 9 months right after his PhD in a think tank in Washington, D.C. and gives it up to become a motorcycle repair.
Yeah.
You know, owner operator.
Yeah.
And unusual.
So, yeah. 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 Restoring old vintage BMW motorcycles. Mm-hmm. So that's a high calling.
It is.
Yeah. Mm. But I think there's a parallel here. Like you could almost, well, Ferdy does say this actually, the life of the Christian is best engaged in a way through the everyday work of the hands, right? If you can think of it that way. It's that stuff that you don't even know that you're doing in a lot of ways because you're simply just getting up and going through your life. Mm-hmm. You know, you're not really waking up in the morning and going, oh, man, what can I do to be a great Christian today? You're sort of just waking up and doing your day's work. You know, you're pouring your coffee, pouring your wife a cup, getting the kids off to school, getting yourself off to work, doing your thing, picking them up, you know, feeding them dinner. And you're not even really taking the time to think about, wow, is there an extra special way that I can do something for God today in this? Because the whole day is spent doing things for God because you're doing it for your neighbors, your wife, your children, you know, mm-hmm. your coworkers, the whole nine yards. And I think that this is missed in evangelicalism. I hear the stories, you know, I go to some of these conferences now and you'll hear the conferences led by people who once were evangelicals who are now, I'd say, law gospel Christians or monergist Christians in a lot of ways. And they'll say, you know, I remember I used to spend so much of my day like making sure that my wife and I spent enough time in prayer and in quiet time with Jesus and everything in order to serve God. And that can be stifling.
I mean,
that could be debilitating.
Yep.
But it's not, I don't think it's as debilitating to say, live your life.
Mm-hmm. And it's in praise to God, whether you know it or not.
Right. Yeah. I mean, I tell people when I teach this, I say, this is going to be the simplest, most complicated thing you've heard in a long time. Because it's so simple that you're going to leave here thinking, you know, thinking again and again and again and again. It can't be that simple. It can't. Mm-hmm. It can't be that simple. Mm-hmm. It's sort of like what you said in one of the last episodes, Rod, about your debate with the Roman Catholic, where they leave, the people in the audience leave, and what the Roman Catholic presented about synergism, right? God does his part, you do your part. The husband and wife leave, and the husband says, well, what the Catholic guy said really makes sense to me. I had no idea what Rosenblatt's talking about, you know, when in reality you're giving a much simpler message. Christ has done it for you. Mm-hmm. But it's so simple that it's complicated, you know, because we loop on it. We go back over it again and again. And I think the same thing is true here. I really do.
Well, Crawford ends his book with the final chapter is about the distinction between a job site, a crew, and an office team.
Yeah.
And it's such an important distinction that he, or a bunch of distinctions that he makes. One of them is that a job site crew building a house is able to see the fruits of their labor as the building is erected, mm-hmm. where somebody selling something that they don't manufacture, they don't produce, they don't distribute, as a team in an office is managing a collective group of personalities. And he said that's, you know, that's one major distinction. But one of the things I think is really interesting, Mike Rowe from
Dirty Jobs.
And now a lot of what he does, now that show's over, is dedicating his life to people who don't necessarily need to go to college getting vocational jobs.
Yeah, Micro Works Project. But, you know, he's really a fan of saying, you know, do what you are good at, do what you can be paid for, mm-hmm. and take your passion along with you.
Yeah.
But I think that culture now says, follow your passion.
Yeah.
You know, under any circumstances. So if that's, you know, 15th century theology, or if it's 18th yeah. century literature, you know, we have, you know, we rack up, you know, tens of thousands of dollars in debt to follow a passion that people can't be paid for.
Yeah.
It's not going to serve your neighbors. It's not going to feed your children.
Yeah, that's kind of the key, too. Like, there's no demand, like in your the work outside your home. If there's no demand for what you're doing, is it serving your neighbor?
That's right.
Mm-hmm. You know?
Mm-hmm. So. Which is probably why, I mean, most people, I forget what the statistic is. It's far over 50% of people work in a field outside of what their college degree is.
Oh,
If they have one. Mm-hmm. Or if it's related, it's, you know, tangentially related.
Oh, it's 27%.
Yeah.
27% work in a field that they were actually educated in.
Yeah. I mean, and so,
wow.
Yeah, it makes a lot more sense that you're going to have to work, you know, doing what you can do to get paid. And sometimes those are, some of the most fulfilling jobs you can have.
Yeah, that's funny. I mean, I didn't work in a field that was related to my degree for a long time, and I've said this a lot about, this is sort of a tangent here, but I've sort of said the same thing about making a lot of money and not making a lot of money. I can't, in my life, Caleb could attest, there's been both, right? There's been times when I've made a good living and times when I've made a very poor living. And I can't measure a difference, a tangible difference for me in the degree of quote unquote happiness
right.
for me or my children during those times. I just can't. Mm-hmm. I think you could measure a difference in the degree of, you know, worry, but that difference is qualitative, not quantitative. You still worry when you have resources. You're just worrying about different stuff, you mm-hmm. know. When you don't have a lot of money, you're worrying about things that are money related. When you do have enough money, you're worrying about things that are money related from a different perspective, mm-hmm. you know. But I would say the same thing about working in my field of education and out of my field of education, you know, that I was very satisfied doing what I did at the city, in Carson City. I'm very satisfied doing what I do now. And I think you're right on to that. The level of satisfaction that I brought to what I did at the city is when I felt like I was actually able to help people and to mm-hmm. serve people there. And what changed for me there is I felt like that was changing and I was less able to do that. And so that's when I actually left working for the city to try to find something where I felt like I could do that again. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't necessarily following my passion for being a city bureaucrat, you know, it was following my passion for wanting to help people, you know, in a sense, and or do something that was useful, you know. And I think that that's
your job at the city was Ron Swanson, right? You were you worked for the Parks and Rec Department.
I did work for the Parks and Rec Department. I didn't have the mustache though. Mm. Fun. So I want to end. I use this Ferdy quote all the time now at the end of when I teach being dad that has to do with vocation. And the reason I use it is because people may or may not know that Luther was more often than not accused of not having a solid doctrine of sanctification. That's the classic jab against Lutheranism generally too, right? That you guys are great on justification, you guys are weak on sanctification. Mm-hmm. That's sort of the jab that comes at us all the time. And you know, this is often true of people who teach about Luther too, right? Who sort of get too close to the marrow of Luther's theology. They're often accused too of not having any doctrine of sanctification also, which was true for Gerhard Ferdy. It's been true of me. Yep. It's been true of Dr. Rosenblatt. Yep.
You're one trick ponies.
Yeah. It's true of Aaron. probably true of Caleb. But this is what Ferdy says in response to that sort of jab against, and he does it in terms of, there's two things I always like to preface here. He's speaking for Luther, number one, primarily, but then he's speaking from his perspective as a teacher. So the images he creates are teacher-student images, but you can apply them however. He says this, "People who complain that Luther has no proper doctrine of good works and sanctification or ethics," we love that word, don't we?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
"Always seem to forget this understanding of the Christian's calling. Perhaps because it is so utterly realistic and unromantic." That's worth saying again, because it's so utterly realistic and unromantic. "But virtually everything Luther wants to say about ethics comes back to his doctrine of vocation. One is to serve God in one's occupation, in one's concrete daily life, and its duties in the world. He says, when I tell students that, this first of all means that they should pay attention to being better students, they are often a little disappointed. They had more romantic things in mind, like leading some protest, manning the barricades, joining in some romantic crusade or social action. It does not occur to them that their first ethical duty is to be good students. Whatever call there might be for more extreme action, it must be remembered that Luther's idea is that first and foremost, one serves God by taking care of his creation." I mean, I think that sums it up. When I teach this, I'll often say to people, because I started getting the question, "Well, what does this look like for you?" And I said, my kids are all out of the house now, and Caleb likes to say that's because they're all
in my house. Yeah, sorry. your mom would probably do that too.
But my reality is that for me, that usually looks like, you know, getting up in the morning, stumbling down the steps, making my coffee like I would normally make my coffee, mm-hmm. and every once in a while remembering as I pour my cup to pour my wife a cup too. Mm-hmm. To bring it in the living room, give her a kiss, tell her I love her, and then get on with my day. Mm-hmm. You know, it's simple. And two, understanding how much and how thoroughly I'm forgiven for the multiple mornings when I forget to do just that.
Mm-hmm. Sure. So. Sure. And again, Luther would say, this is the Christian in action. And you say, what in the things that prosaic? And he would say, yes. In things that prosaic, that daily, that normal, that plain, that... And he would say without reservation, as we've heard him quoted, this is more praising to God than anything a monk or nun ever did.
Right. And he says that specifically because that's the thought of his time.
Yep.
You know? Yep. If you want to serve God in Luther's time, you give up everything and you go to a monastery.
Yep.
You don't just get married and have kids and be a rear good them. Father and rear them. I mean, you don't. That's not it. You do something very dramatic.
Yep.
It's, yeah. You're not going to earn God's favor by doing something very dramatic. That favor has been earned by Christ and is given to you freely.
Yeah, it doesn't need dramatic. That was the drama, and it was outside of you but for you.
That's right. And now, live your life freely.
Very good. This is a great place to end this episode. Thank you for joining us once again to listen in and partake in our conversation. We need listener support as much as we can get it. So please continue to listen to this show. Please, if you know you find this of value, share it with those people around you who might also enjoy this conversation. And if you have the desire to support the show in a financial capacity, you can contact me at caleb@1517legacy.com or visit the Thinking Fellows website, and there's a donate button there where you can support the show. It's a free podcast, and we like to keep it that way, and we will keep it that way, but there are definitely costs associated with bringing you this content every week. So thank you for those of you who keep the show going regularly, and we look forward to bringing you more episodes as we approach the new year. All right, bye.